You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of February 2018 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
let us deal with the current moment and work together on how we are going to improve the lives of our people rather than grandstanding, rather than standing on big platforms. That's all I want to say.
Cyril Ramaphosa is the new president of South Africa. My guests, Tim Marshall and Marie Billon, will be reflecting on what that means for the country's future and discussing the day's other top stories, including...
I mean, here we are, and we're like the latest statistic on school violence. And as a society, as Americans, we're failing our children. We're not keeping them safe. And Congress is failing us, and the government is failing us, and something has to be done.
A teacher who witnessed the latest mass shooting in a school in the US speaks out. We'll ask whether the American people, rather than its deadlocked government, can move the gun control debate forward. We'll also be hearing why French President Emmanuel Macron wants to bring back military service and discuss why Finnish knitwear has become the talk of the Winter Olympics. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Tim Marshall, foreign affairs analyst, author and editor of The What and TheWire.com, and Marie Billon, UK correspondent for French media outlets. Welcome both to the programme. Now, Jacob Zuma, until yesterday president of South Africa, has resigned. His exit follows a prolonged effort to remove him by members of his own party, the ANC, thanks to the politician having become synonymous with allegations of corruption. His successor as president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has been waiting to assume the role since becoming ANC leader back in December, and was Nelson Mandela's favourite to lead long before that. So, can scandal-blighted South Africa now regain some positive political momentum? Tim, can it?
Yes. I will put aside my normal bleak view of the future of the world, which is not really that bleak, it's actually doing quite well. This Ramaphosa, his time has finally come, age 65. As you said there, Mr. Mandela felt that he was the natural successor. It didn't happen. It was Mbeki, Thabo Mbeki, and then this guy Zuma, who has been not a disaster, but he has overseen a rapid slide into corruption, unemployment, health rates are going down. You know, you name it. He's not done well. Ramaphosa is a billionaire, so hopefully less corruptible than many other politicians in his country. He does appear to have a real core of decency about him. You know, he's not fraternized with the wrong people. I think he's capable of pulling the ANC together. I think he will inject the life back into the ANC, because the Liberation Party felt it would rule forever. But, you know, it's 25 years now. Younger generation don't feel they owe as much to the ANC. So he'll be this new figure. I think he'll bring them together. They'll hold an election next year. And because of him and because of this new injection, I suspect they will win. And then it's up to him and who he appoints to start turning the country round, because it really has gone downhill in the last few years.
Marie, when we saw Nelson Mandela come to power, there was a sense that this was the African country that would come good, that would be a place where black and white got on, that business could thrive, that, you know, education would come to the fore, that actually there was wealth and opportunity for everyone to do kind of well. And so much of that has been lost. And mainly through this, as we said, this sense that there is deep corruption running to the very heart of the state. That's the most complicated thing to turn around, isn't it? Once it becomes ingrained in how business has been done.
Yes, indeed. And the fact that, of course, there's a new president, that's great in some respect, but that's not enough to improve the country. I mean, the ANC is still the ruling party, and he's been the president of the ANC for only 2 months. So there's still a lot of things to do within the party, a lot of things to do within the government. And you need fresh blood. You need new people. You were talking about, Tim was talking about younger people who don't owe as much as the older generation to the Liberation Party. That's quite true, because basically it's a past. And like many countries who've been traumatized, there's perhaps this idea that you have to think about the past, not to reproduce it, but somehow you have to leave it aside a bit, not to be, you know, burdened by it. And that made a generation that perhaps feels less a responsibility towards what their ancestor, or not ancestor, but basically the older did. So it's a new page for South Africa, I think. But it's just not even the first chapter. It's just the introduction so far.
And what do we make of, you know, Zuma's resignation speech? Even now, he doesn't seem to think that he did a single thing wrong. And his relationship with the Guptas doesn't seem to bother him that much either.
No, he thinks that every single one of the, I think it's 784 charges against him, are all politically motivated, and he's not guilty of any of them. He had to be dragged kicking and screaming into paying back the money that he pretty much stole from the South African people to do up his presidential palace and buy a string of horses, etc., etc. He just refuses to accept that he's done anything wrong, which, of course, is one of the reasons why he's gone, because the ANC was becoming synonymous with corruption, and for the man at the very top is leading it, which is why the sort of reform liberal wing of the ANC, if you like, felt they had to move against him. It took them a couple of years to within the ANC structure, to get enough power to have the vote 2 months ago to move him out and to get Ramaphosa in. I really am hopeful of this man. I think a lot of politics remains to do with character, and I think that this guy's, Ramaphosa's character, may carry them forward. The reason that South Africa became called the Rainbow Nation was because of Mandela, because he was the one man that could reach out to the Afrikaans-speaking whites, to the English-speaking whites, to the Zulus, to the Xhosa, etc., etc., and really bring them together. And there was that sense then that this was happening, and it did happen for a while, and there was a great deal of reconciliation, but particularly under Zuma, that has drifted. And I think Ramaphosa is the man to bring them back. But the structural problems are massive, not just corruption, but the infrastructure. And you're probably following it, Andrew, but the water crisis in Cape Town, that crisis is about to really hit them. And how they deal with that is going to be very interesting.
When we look at the way forward, is part of the need here to entice the international community back? Because many people have been cautious, Marie, about investing. You know, the rand has fluctuated in terrible ways, mostly down, and there's a feeling that it wasn't, you know, the safest place to base your business.
Well, now, I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa, he's a businessman. He's someone who knows how business work, and apparently the business community, the markets, even investors, they already basically pushed a sigh of relief when it was heard that Zuma had decided to step down when he did, and that Cyril Ramaphosa was taking over. So it's going to be a bit of fresh air, perhaps, for business. And the fact that he used to be a union leader, and he was a businessman as well, meaning that basically he's a bit himself a broad church. He can speak to not just, you know, the wealthy side of the population, the wealthy part of the population, or just who could do good for themselves, but also those who are still struggling, who are working, the workmen. And that's quite important as well, of course, because if he wants to basically heal the wounds of South Africa that has been reopened with corruption, the fact that some people could get away with a driving offence just because they had the money on the police in their pocket, and those who didn't, they were rushing to go to work or anything to do for their kids, for example, and they just couldn't get out of it because of corruption. That's going to be a big ask, of course, to stop this endemic corruption. But he may be seen by the people as the only person now at this moment in South Africa who can do it.
Tim, is there a bit of an Africa spring happening? Because we've seen in Angola moves against the former president, you know, the deposing of his daughter from positions of power within leading businesses. We've seen the stepping down of Robert Mugabe. the new president come in. And overnight, we've seen the death also of Morgan Tsvangirai, obviously a more democratic leader. But just a feeling that the whole of Southern Africa is potentially manoeuvring a little bit.
Well, yeah, you started about saying African Spring and then ended up about saying Southern Africa.
Yeah,
because you know we can't look at it as a whole because it is such a disparate, massive place, and the different parts of it are very different from each other. That said, I'm still not convinced that there's an African Spring now. If you look at Zimbabwe, the man that's taken over is the crocodile who oversaw the slaughter in Matabele land 25 years ago. Angola, yes, that was a positive change of power without violence. But at the moment, all the countries are still struggling with the same old issues. Like I said, if it comes down to character, I've got less faith in the crocodile in Zimbabwe than I have in Ramaphosa in South Africa.
Well, we're going to stick with the gruesome issue of violence because the US suffered yet another horrific mass shooting in a school yesterday. Nicholas Cruz, aged 19, opened fire at the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, killing 17 and injuring more. But the familiar rhetoric of thoughts and prayers coming from US politicians following atrocities such as these is this time being met with a new and more forthright response from the media and public alike. US legislators' cozy relationship with the nation's biggest gun lobbyist group, the NRA, are under the spotlight, with the group's donations to the Republican election campaign in 2016 having run into many millions of dollars. Tim, you know, unfortunately, over the few years that we've done Monocle 24, I've had this debate with people in the studio again and again, and you know, it makes no sense to non-Americans why there is never any shift in policy.
I share your view on this thoughts and prayers. I mean, it's starting to be more than just a cliche. It makes me a little bit cross when I hear it, especially when I hear it from certain politicians that are actually part of the problem of gun control. So the NRA, formed in 1871, only really began lobbying in the 30s, but they've become a very big lobbyist in Washington. And they've got a budget of about $250 million a year. $250 million a year gets you quite a lot of lobbying. And if you're talking about small grassroots organizations, I'm not talking about the big corporate lobbyists. That's another issue about American politics and how it's funded. But the NRA, as a single issue grassroots organization, which is what it is, just dwarfs all the others and has massive, massive budget in comparison to the lobbying budgets of the small groups that are trying to go against gun control. So you're hitting that wall immediately. You're hitting another wall in that you can't stop them lobbying and funding because of a Supreme Court decision in 2010, which said that contributions to political parties are part of free speech, consequently are protected by the First Amendment. So the very American democratic system itself mitigates against stopping people pouring huge sums of money into Washington to make sure that gun control is not enacted. So you go either round in circles and or into a brick wall.
Marie, as Tim says, you know, that it's this time when you have Donald Trump as the president who, you know, he got into power by saying he was representing the people who were, you know, not normally listened to, and that included many rural people, many people who are, you know, proponents of, you know, carrying guns. He can't even begin that conversation because, you know, Obama did try and start the conversation, and it, you know, he ran into numerous roadblocks. But Donald Trump is not even going to begin that conversation, is he?
No, what we know so far about Donald Trump, his strategy, if ever he has one, is not to alienate his base. That's how he was elected and how he's going to stay in power. And his base is the gun-loving Americans, not only them, but them in particular. He said they would be their best friend. So he certainly don't want to have them against him. And and they helped him quite clearly to be elected. I mean, we were talking about the budget of the NIA. They have two strategies, I understand. They try to lobby in favor of some candidates, and Donald Trump apparently had quite a big chunk of money to boost it in the polls. I read somewhere $14 million made to basically help him in terms of advertisement during the campaign. But they also have the other side is to target Democrats, those who are very much against gun control, or are very much in favor of gun control. They want to basically discreditate them. And they even have a bigger budget for that. They have $45 million last in 2016 to try and discredit them, basically to make them look weak or just unintelligent or this kind of thing. And that's I mean, when you see this kind of money being used to help someone and being used to attack people, you can see that there's something perhaps a bit, of course, wrong in the way politics works in the US. But you can see as well how Donald Trump hands are tied, because he's not the most, you know, he's not the broad-church president, so he has to cure to his base, and his base is the one who will still give him the public approval and the money needed in the US politics to stay and perhaps to be re-elected if he wants to.
But everything you've said is true, Marie, but it's actually also democratic, what they've done. People have the right to say, this is what I think. I happen to have some money. I'm going to choose to give it to you because I want you to further my ideals. That's actually democratic. Now, I don't like it. Don't get me wrong. I don't like the National Rifle Association's views on gun control. But it's fundamental to democracy that it's about ideas and it's also about personalities. So the personality has to propagate the idea. Now, how do they do that? Well, you need television advertising and radio, and you need to a car and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that requires funding. Will you please help me? Yes. So then you come up against the thing, what are the limits? Now, personally, I would much rather see a system where once you reach a certain threshold of support, it kicks in, that the state will fund your campaign and you're not allowed to pay more. They did have it in the States, and then came along this system of super PACs where you don't directly fund the candidate. You fund a different organization that somehow then propagates the candidate's views. So you get round the problems of the candidate not being directly funded. And round we go. And I came across a very interesting system in one of the American cities at local level. An individual can be given four $25 vouchers, and they can give these $25 vouchers to whichever cause they choose to be used for funding. Now, it's probably open to sort of corruption, but, you know, that's the sort of ideas that need to be injected into if you want to have a democracy that is not just about who is best funded wins.
And the strange thing is, you know, that there, you can't push any of this debate through a filter of logic, because you have Donald Trump saying, you know, we need to stop, you know, people coming from all these African countries because there's a potential threat that one of them may potentially be a terrorist.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's very little evidence for that. But then you have this level of violence and there is no action taken.
Yeah. Briefly, sorry, Maria. Against all that, also, Jeb Bush spent more than most candidates and got absolutely nowhere. Donald Trump actually spent less than many and got a long way. So it's an incredibly complicated situation.
Well, we're going to leave that issue there. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Marie Billon and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, Emmanuel Macron is looking to bring back conscription in France. But does he have a fight on his hands?
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and still with me are Marie Bion and Tim Marshall. France phased out mandatory military service at the turn of the millennium, but now its dynamic new leader, Emmanuel Macron, wants to bring it back, and his aims have confused the French public. Some see the bolstering of ranks as a pragmatic move in turbulent times. Others think this might just be an attempt to satisfy the more nostalgic, nationalistic French voter. Marie, which is it?
It's a bit both. It's a bit of both. He's a politician. We are sometimes tempted to forget that Emmanuel Macron is a politician now. So, of course, he wants to cater for those who wouldn't have voted for him at the beginning. But it's also his view of society. He says he wants to be a humanist president, and it goes through basically civic responsibilities and the fact that the young people in France at the moment have some kind of, you know, civic courses during the history lessons doesn't make it for any kind of, you know, it doesn't teach them how to, what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be solidarity, what does it mean, and this kind of thing, giving your time. That's not something that French young people are taught. You have to rely on families to basically make sure that they know that they have this option of helping people if they want to. And that's it might not look like I'm talking about military at this moment, but it is, because Emmanuel Macron, what he wants to do, because he wants to compulsory military service. Yes, but many buts, because it was really fudged this debate in France. Yes, but military, but in two parts. It's going to be 3 to 6 months. One part only might be compulsory, and there will be one military for sure, and the other one will be more helping people, civil service, some civic service somehow. And because he wants to paint military service as something that's time giving and efforts given to the nation, he wants to be shown that he's not just, you know, someone who promotes violence as a way to build a new France. He says that basically giving your time, it's good to give your time and understand what's the role that France plays within West Africa or within the rest of the world. But it's also important that solidarity with other countries charity begins at home, basically. And if you want to help the other country and the world to get better, you have to help each other and in French society to get better. So it will be a two-part military service, one military and not so much military, basically.
Now, Tim, here in the UK, when these calls go up for, you know, let's do national service again, the first people to say no are the army. They're like, hold on, you know, we don't want all these kind of like unruly kind of youngsters coming in and have no interest in being in the army. We're a professional force, and it's just a huge distraction of time and effort trying to take people, especially for like 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. Yeah. It looks like a PR stunt, doesn't it?
It does, and I doubt it'll ever come to fruition. I mean, he had it in his manifesto last year, so it's not a surprise. It's not a new idea. But when he announced it a few days ago, the French political class went, oh, really? What, you meant that? And first of all, you had one minister saying, well, of course, there won't be any barracks building, and another minister saying, well, it won't be compulsory, and then the Élysée Palace, well, yes, it will be compulsory. I mean, they don't seem to be very joined up. I'm not sure it'll happen. But it's not about the military. It's about nation building. It's about society building, again, as Marie alluded to. It's about forging a cohesive society where people from many different backgrounds, different classes, different parts of the country, different ethnicities come together, are forced together to live together for X weeks and to cooperate so that the country better knows itself.
And on that, maybe there's a good thing, is there, Marie?
You can make an argument for it.
The thing is, the minister said it's not going to be about building barracks. Yeah. And you say it's the coming together on young people. Yes, but what he meant, while we are not going to build barracks, is that basically young people won't have to leave home.
Yeah, exactly.
For that.
You're going to nip home in the evening. I mean,
yes, nation building, not
it's,
so
it's
much.
It's not really national. I mean, national services is the headline grabber. It is actually something else. I'm not quite sure. Against what I just said, and I actually think there is a very strong cogent argument for that bringing people together and civil service is one of the ways you could do it. And that includes, you know, you're standing next to someone who's very, very wealthy and they're cleaning the toilet as well. I mean, there are positive aspects to that. Against it is... I'll get a deferment for 10 years while I extend my university studies. And also, the class issue will probably creep in. I mean, that happened in the Vietnam War. The Americans, the richer kids, managed to get out of it and the working class kids didn't.
I also remember meeting a Dutch person when they had a military service saying that there was a maximum height if you were over which you didn't have to do military service. So the day before his military service, he hung himself upside down from a pole
in
to stretch his back by the key centimetre to get out of it.
France wants to join. I was just looking through. This is many. Most countries don't have it. Greece does, Israel, North Korea, Brazil, Nigeria, Cyprus, Iran, Russia, Ukraine, Turkey. China has it on the books, but doesn't enact it because there's so many people that join up anyway, they don't need any more
Swiss,
people.
The Swiss have a version as well.
And a navy, yeah.
And we were speaking to, again, a Swiss colleague the other day who was off to do his service, but he's doing social service. He was having to do a month working in an old age pensioner's home. But because he's chosen to do the social service, it's going to add to his tax burden until he's 30. He has to pay an additional tax. And oddly, he didn't seem
to... It'll make a man of him.
It will make a man of him and certainly help the tax office. Well, finally, we return to the Winter Olympics. The latest soft power success at the event comes in the form of a Finn with a penchant for knitting. The Finnish snowboarding coach was caught on camera creating a beautifully crafted piece of knitwear while waiting for one of his athletes to compete in the men's halfpipe snowboarding event. And it's got the world interested in just what else goes on in Finland, widely considered to be one of the most comfortable and well-adjusted nations on earth. Marie, we look for these human stories in events like the Winter Olympics because they're such elite athletes, and we can't quite grasp, you know, their dedication and their prowess. But when one of the coaches starts knitting, it's quite endearing, isn't it? And it's certainly better than a kind of a North Korean parade of kind
yes.
of. Yes, marionettes.
It is more endearing, it's true. And it's not just him. Maybe he was on the slopes, basically. That's why he was so touching, basically. But even for the last Winter Olympic, you could see the Finnish team knitting. I think it was kind of an overall for a baby because someone had a baby recently, so the whole team came together to knit something. So it's something that's apparently quite team-building. Team-building by knitting is something that I don't think will have much traction if you ask to do that to a rugby team, for example. So I think it's quite it is quite nice, basically. But and when I saw that, I thought, but I mean, he didn't have any gloves. How did he do with? I mean, he was quite freezing there.
In Pyeongchang, it's been very cold. Tim, again, you know, the Winter Olympics are interesting because you know there are so many great sports events going on, but we are trying to filter it. It seems through all these human interest stories. Yeah. You know, the North Korean cheerleaders, the activities of the kind of the young American sports star who stayed in bed, got up late, forgot his coat, and still won a gold medal. Is this how we can only really come to terms with these huge events, do you think?
I think it helps us, and it also helps national stereotypes. But briefly on the North Korean cheerleaders, I think the media has just rolled over, not you personally or Monocle, but much of the media has rolled over and had its tummy tickled on that. These are carefully chosen young, good-looking women whose families back home are saying, please don't defect, otherwise we'll all get murdered, who are guarded by Secret Service agents. You know, I see very, very little cuddly about the North Korean cheerleader story. And briefly on the Finns, this is one guy that's knitting. He looks a pretty cool guy. I really like him. But whether you can extrapolate from that Finland is the most comfortable country in the world, it is one of the happiest. But conversely, and this is where I'm going back into my miserable old grumpy man, 15th highest suicide rate in the world, 3rd highest suicide rate in the European Union, highest gun ownership in the European Union, and the highest murder rate in Western Europe. They're not all that cuddly.
And if you wanted to know how odd it really is, you could meet Marcus Hippie, who works for us.
I've been there. It is weird. No, it's lovely. I love it, but it's an interesting place.
Let's just say, if he ever gets you to Helsinki, you'll be in a sauna before you've kind of made it to the hotel.
And a bar.
And normally the bar's in the sauna, I think. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Tim Marshall and Marie Beyond, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by James Kitchen. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. There's more music next. And then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist. It's a very good show. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.